Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Friday, the 19th of April. Coming up on the program, why Tshwane's mayor is confident that the metro is turning a corner. An in-depth look at our entrepreneurial environment and where we're failing. The rand above 19 to the dollar and another petrol price hike is looming. Why so few children grow up with books. And are we failing when it comes to food policy and regulation? Let's start with city politics, and the mayor of Tshwane, Silias Brink, says he is more optimistic than ever about the capital city's future. Those are big words, given the problems that the metro has been facing now and in the past. And he joins me now on MoneyWeb at Midday. Mayor Brink, welcome to you, and I'm interested in your reconciliation between the optimism that you're showing in your State of the City address and the ongoing financial troubles and the big debtors book that the Tshwane metro faces.
Hi, Jeremy. Great to chat to you. So the important point is just to show or to point to the progress that we have made. Ratings Africa have said that Tshwane is the metro in the country that's made the most progress in the past year on financial sustainability. We've also been able to achieve an improved audit outcome. But Jeremy, it's more about what I have learned about local government in the past 10 years. This is not my first rodeo. When Solim Samunga was the mayor of Tshwane, I served in his mayoral committee. And the key thing for us always was, how do you get a good management team in place? Because politicians can make promises, we can get our mandate from the voters, but if you don't have strong professionals with integrity in positions such as the city manager, the head of the metro police, the CFO, the head of audit, you don't have any chance of really making a difference. And finally, we have that. We've got good people permanently appointed, and I believe that is going to change the culture of the city. Of course, many things can still happen. Our financial recovery is far from complete. A lot of work still needs to be done, but at least we have people of integrity who are committed to the cause, and that's the best that a city mayor and government can hope for to begin with.
And I'm sure that the residents of Tshwane will take solace from that, but I want to come back to the debtors book that the city still faces and how you realistically plan to address those financial deficits. And maybe start off by telling us just how bad it is.
So we've got a 23.3 billion rand debtors book. In other words, this is money owed to the city. And that is a sign of how the city's tax administration system has broken down over many years. Lockdown was disastrous for many, many municipalities. We were but one, but we definitely saw that during that time and the hardships that people suffered, debt collection deteriorated rapidly. Now, whereas the debtors book is that big, it also gives us the opportunity to collect at the very least, a quarter of that debtors book in the next few months. And we propose to do that by simply getting the basics in place. We're establishing a project management office under the new CFO that will look at every aspect of our revenue value chain, from cost reflective tariffs and property rates to making sure that we manage our bulk account with Eskom and Rand Water, to making sure that services are metered properly, that bills are dispatched, that disputes are resolved expeditiously, and then of course our very, very aggressive credit control and debt collection operation under the theme Tshwane Yatima, because we simply have to insist that folks pay for the services they consume beyond the very generous portion of free basic services offered by the city of Tshwane.
25% of 23 billion is a big ask, though.
It is a big ask, but that is money that is owed to us. We have done an assessment of the debtor's book. We've identified what the most collectible part of that debtor's book is. We'll obviously do our reviews, but that's our focus. And we've got it down to the households and the businesses where we are quite certain that those folks are either in a position to make an arrangement or to pay the full amount to the municipality. But Jeremy, more than that, more than just the debtor's book, in aiming at this debtor's book, at this 6 billion rand of collectibles over the next few months, that is what it's going to concentrate our minds in rebuilding the system. So it's not just about collecting historical debt, it's about collecting what is due to the city on a current basis. So it is very much a stretch goal, but if we don't aim at it, and if other municipalities, quite frankly, in Gauteng, don't aim at similar targets, then the downward spiral, unfortunately, is going to continue.
Is part of your strategy wielding a big stick when it comes to people who are in default?
The first message is thank you to the 6 out of 10 households who do pay their bills on time. The second message is if you're in arrears, please approach the municipality to make some kind of a payment arrangement. And we are changing staff and appointing managers and resources in order to deal with those queries directed to the municipality. It's only the last message that says, if you refuse to make any kind of arrangement, if you continue to pay other bills, DSTV, luxury car installments, but you don't pay for the water and electricity that you consume, we will have to take credit action like anybody else who's got a service, and particularly a trading service, to offer.
Mayor Brink, you mentioned improvements in audit outcomes, but moving from an adverse to a qualified audit still, I would contend, indicates significant issues.
There are significant issues, and we've said at the outset, the qualified audit by itself is no reason to celebrate. However, it is important to note that the things we are doing is achieving progress. Right at the outset last year when I was elected, I indicated that there were 3 fundamental findings that led to the negative audit outcome. We've been able to clear 2 of those findings related to cash flow and creditors. The last finding related to the valuation and categorization of property, plant and equipment was more complicated. I said last year we wouldn't be able to clear that in one audit cycle. But Jeremy, I'm quite confident that we're making progress. We will clear that finding this year, and I'm confident that we'll achieve at least an unqualified audit outcome.
Silius Brink is the Mayor of Tshwane. Thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Well, let's pivot now from politics to entrepreneurship. And our next guest is Dr. Pumlani Nkontwana, who is the founding academic director of the Alan Gray Center for Africa. And he asks this, and I think it's a key question: which countries in Africa provide a healthy environment for entrepreneurship? And the answer might just lie in the newly developed African Entrepreneurial Ecosystem Index. He joins us now on the program. So first of all, Dr. Nkontwana, what in your opinion constitutes a healthy environment for entrepreneurship?
When we talk about a healthy environment from an entrepreneurship point of view, you can distill it down to 2 terms. One is density, and the other one is momentum. So effectively, what that means is you need a concentration of resources in a locality. So you need a concentration of support, funding organization, and talent in that area. And that concentration must be matured enough that there's successes that are already feeding back to that ecosystem, who are entrepreneurs in that ecosystem, so that there's role modeling, that there's money circulating within that ecosystem. And that comes from what we call momentum, which is effectively a lot of organizations making noise, advocacy, promotion and other approaches to promote entrepreneurship in that area. So you start from momentum and you land with density of resources.
So if you look at those two measurements then, density and momentum, do those conditions exist in South Africa right now?
No. No, we're even more problematic. So we... when you talk about the South African entrepreneurial ecosystem, basically people distill it down to Johannesburg and Cape Town. In fact, if you pick up any report globally that talks about the South African ecosystem, they basically reduce it to two cities. And we have, more than two cities, of course. We have more than two provinces, for that matter. So that just tells you what I just mentioned now, which is that that's because there's a lot of resources and concentration of support organizations in those two cities. However, even if you zoom into those cities, there's massive problems. We effectively don't have the necessary talent for all forms of entrepreneurship that we need for our economy. And we have effectively what we call techno-chauvinism, which is effectively the obsession of tech firms and therefore tech hubs. So the South African context has reduced entrepreneurship effectively to apps and digitization of solutions. But of course, we need more than that, because that type of entrepreneurship doesn't actually create jobs. And it's good also to understand that why we do entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship in and of itself is not good if it's not going to deliver on the common good. So the promise of entrepreneurship is creating jobs and delivering on social change.
And
but it hasn't. It hasn't because the forms of entrepreneurship that are predominant in these two cities have not been a game changer for employment. I mean, a typical tech startup at the moment employs anything from 8, if you're lucky, 20 people. So it's very few that have gone to even 50. I don't want to mention the successful startups in this country, because I don't want to come across as criticizing them, because they're making a difference. But the point is, we need plurality of entrepreneurship, not mono-entrepreneurship. And that's my observation of the South African ecosystem. And it's not unique to South Africa. That's the problem with African ecosystems in general at the moment.
What, in your opinion, construes entrepreneurial talent, which is critical to serve both of those measurement points?
Yeah, so we are lucky. I haven't even spoken about the index. I was just distilling the kind of, if you distill ecosystems to two things, but effectively talent in entrepreneurial talent in an environment are people that have all the right, what we call competencies, mindsets, intentions, and experiences. And we have been doing various studies at the center for years, looking at measuring these constructs. And we do all forms of studies in a partnership with other scholars. And we've distilled basically in our research to 13 entrepreneurial competencies. And for us, we distinguish between what we call innate, which is less trainable, versus trainable competencies. So what that means is that there are some things that you cannot train for that have to come from an environment, hence my point about density and concentration. So you cannot train someone to have a need for achievement. That's not something you can get a degree for. You cannot train someone to have a need for autonomy. They have to have that innate drive to be independent. But you can train someone for communications, managing finances, etc. So we have these 13 competencies. About 7 of them are innate and 6 of them are trainable. And then if you couple that with entrepreneurial experience, which can only come if there are firms that are growing that can absorb young people early enough, that they give them that entrepreneurial experience. Not what we have at the moment, which is basically corporatism. And corporatism is inaccessible. Hence, we talk about unemployment. So, and that's what's different about other contexts that have done well in terms of entrepreneurship. They've got a lot of these young firms in high numbers in the right density than in distributed locality, which then engenders entrepreneurship.
And that measurement is called the Entrepreneurial Ecosystem Index. Dr. Nkontwana, thank you very much indeed. Academic Director at the Centre, I do appreciate that explanation. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it's common cause that we need a healthy diet, but to what extent in a challenged economy like ours is this being denied? And what is the socioeconomic impact if we fail to deliver in this respect? I want to explore this a little further with Nzam Mbahlati, who is the Interim Chief Executive Officer of an organization called HeLa. It's a collective of civil society organizations promoting equitable access to nutritious food. A warm welcome to you. So what then are the primary obstacles that we face in ensuring that all citizens have access to that healthy diet that you refer to?
So the biggest obstacles that South Africa have, first and foremost, is the food environment itself. It has been set up to actually not provide alternatives and support people to make healthier food options. And this amount from things like regulation, the regulatory framework, addressing issues of poverty and unemployment, and the issues that we know we're dealing on a day-to-day basis, that, you know, many people cannot afford, you know, to buy food. So sometimes choices are actually often are determined by someone's income and what they can afford. But I think there are also issues of education and literacy on nutrition, which is something that, you know, the kind of health promotion measures in a way that we have normalize the eating pattern of unhealthy food, you know, within. And there are a lot of issues that is perpetuated by the food industry, such as the issue we're dealing with, which is surrounding around the marketing, the vigorous marketing of this food in a way that it has become normal to actually be eating an unhealthy food and convenient to be eating a healthy food than you know, having a healthy food.
So these are companies that are pushing sugar and fat, for instance.
Yes, these are companies that are pushing sugar and fat to eat. So they target children, they target even us as adults. So if you look at what could be playing in prime times, but also what is in the package of unhealthy product for children. So I know my children sometimes want products out of the cartoon that is outside the box. I have a teenager who also want, you know, if there's a sportman, celebrity on the product, that they will want that product on those bases. I think we also need to look a lot more in terms of how do we make healthier food options affordable to most people. So if you look at, we could do a lot more in terms of even from Treasury, you know, expanding the food basket that is zero rated to actually food that staple healthy food that people often eat. Because currently, if you look at that package of the subsidized, it's not food for most poor people, and most poor people cannot afford or are not covered on that bracket.
Right. So is it your contention then that this is simply a policy and regulatory failure, or is there more to it than that?
So it is more to it. So the policy and regulatory failures is, we can have more strict measures in terms of food safety, as one, we had the problem of listeriosis and enforcement of the policy and regulatory framework. But over and above, there is also the business practice and the corporate behavior, which is the biggest issue. So this issue is painful, but it's not surprising because it's not an isolated issue in terms of the behavior of the food industry, particularly the unhealthy food industry. So there is a public uproar, but you haven't heard for sure from government that, you know, even Nestle could be called to account, be reined in, and maybe to also have some form of parliamentary process that can probe and look at this. You will find that government actually is silent about this. It's just that there is public uproar. So that is actually one of the biggest problems.
Part of the problem that you're dealing with is that big organizations like this are big contributors in terms of tax to the fiscus. So would it be your suggestion that government goes or is soft on these organizations because of that?
So you are actually very right. So government looks at these companies as social partners, right? But I think even if you have a social partner, I don't think there is any multinational or even South African company that can say they don't want to invest in South Africa. So their biggest market in Africa is here in South Africa, even Nestle. I think the state and government can use much more of their muscle to rein in companies and say, if you're doing business in this country, these are kind of business practices that we cannot accept. I don't think having a conversation about that is actually upsetting, or it's just demanding accountability from your social partner that, you know, you cannot pre-expose kids to food that can cause ill health. So I think this is one of the biggest problems that we see. But, you know, then a Nestle issue, it's not an isolated issue again. And you find
Listeners very quickly, when you talk about the Nestle issue, what concerns you specifically and what outreach have you had to Nestle in that respect?
So the biggest concern with Nestle is that there is a study, undisputed study, that looked at Nestle food portfolio, 150 products, that said a child that is born in Africa, in Asia, in the developing country, is exposed to a food product that is added sugar in it, compared to a child that is born in the global north, in Switzerland, the US, in Europe, that is actually having a meal, a food that is actually doesn't have added sugar in the same portfolio, same product.
Right. So when you've reached out to Nestle, what have they told you?
So Nestle issued a public statement to say, I will not even want to speak on their behalf. But what they said in public is that they actually look at portfolio of products in line with the regulation of the countries, and that they have been reducing sugar in their products overall globally to 11%. So that is not satisfying. I don't think there is an answer to this, because there's no reason to have added sugar anywhere in the world for food products for kids.
Right. Okay, it is a very contentious debate. Obviously, we will reach out to Nestle and give them the right of reply. But Nzama Mbahlati, thank you very much indeed. Interim Chief Executive Officer of Hila. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I'm told that something in the region of 60% of children start grade one without ever holding a book. And this so-called inequality at the starting gate is possibly one of the reasons for South Africa's highly unequal education outcomes in later grades. This is a concern for Deb Zalesniak, who is Chief Executive Officer of the NGO, the Santa Shoebox Project. We have spoken to her before. Deb, welcome and thank you very much for joining us. That figure of 60%, it is alarming. Where does that come from?
It's completely unacceptable. The National Reading Barometer recently reported that 35% of homes with kids under the age of 10 have any picture books. 35% have any. So 65% of homes with children under the age of 10 have no picture books, have no books for children. It certainly starts in the home. We know that that number is sadly supported by poverty. It extends to the early childhood development centers, which are under-resourced and under-supported. Children who live with parents who struggle to put food on the table are simply not going to have access to books at an early age.
So it's a question of prioritization, but sadly there is an impact, because this will have an effect later on academic, social and emotional development.
Absolutely. You know, when we train our caregivers in the use of books, it isn't only in support of literacy. It's in support of so many more developmental milestones, including numeracy, including social development. I mean, the fact that a child of 10 is not able to read for meaning in South Africa is absolutely terrifying. And that number has doubled in the last 5 years. In 2016, that number, let me just confirm this, was 13% of grade 4 pupils who were unable to read for meaning. 5 years later, in 2021, it was 27%. And that's 80% of 10-year-old children, grade 4 pupils.
Apart from just reading the books, I would also suggest to you, and you might disagree with me, that there's also a tactility debate in all of this. It's about physically owning a book. And if you take pride in that ownership, and it's something that you can hang on to, surely that will directly influence a child's educational trajectory.
100%, Jeremy. I mean, the tactility, we're talking about the very basics of motor skills. I mean, that's a given. But the pride, the fact that many impoverished children only ever hold a used book in their hands, that speaks volumes about entrenching that poverty cycle. You know, we've partnered with BookDash. I just cannot sing their song loudly enough. They're a children's book publishing company. Their books are available free for nothing on their website. They've been translated all over the world. They've distributed over 3 million books. And I'm so proud to say that Santa Shoebox will be crossing the 400,000 book mark this year. They have a huge, hairy, audacious goal that every child should own 100 books by the age of 5. It is big and hairy and audacious, but why not? I mean, you know, we're sitting in a position of privilege, but I certainly cannot imagine my childhood without Narnia. I can't imagine my nieces and nephews' childhoods without Harry Potter. You know, why should a child living in an impoverished environment have their very imagination impacted upon and stunted due to lack of access to books?
Notwithstanding the work that you're doing and other NGOs and I guess initiatives by government as well, literacy levels, though, do remain critically low. Do you feel sometimes that you're just banging your head against a wall here?
Well, that's a daily experience, but we live with it. And we, you know, there's absolutely no point in looking at what we can't do. When you work in the NPO sector, focus on an area that floats your boat and make as big a difference as possible. And I firmly believe that the project I represent is doing exactly that. We engage with experts in the fields that we are not experts in, and we leverage that. We're greater than the sum of our parts. And, you know, we set the Santa Shoebox project up as a gifting initiative at the end of the year. When CSI focus shifted to SED, we realized that we were uniquely positioned in having this incredible pipeline into the parents' homes of our beneficiary children and into their classrooms. And what we've done is we have shifted our focus not away from the Santa Shoebox itself, but certainly in the direction of our Santa Shoebox project legacy, which addresses literacy, it addresses teacher training, and it addresses early childhood development infrastructure.
Well, I'm glad we could throw some light on that. Thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And let's finish the program with this. The petrol price is currently on track for a hike at the start of next month. Diesel could be lowered slightly, though. The organization, the AA, monitors this process carefully. And joining us now is Leighton Beard, who speaks for the body. Leighton, welcome to you and thank you. The Rand, as I speak to you today, is really on the back foot. And I guess this is bad news for the petrol price.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. Good afternoon. I mean, it's lost around 4.5% year on year, and it's certainly down from where we had it, you know, a couple of weeks ago. I mean, if I just look at a chart, I mean, last Friday it was at 18.77. Today we're hovering around 19.20. So it's lost a lot of ground, and that is being reflected in the petrol price. Last Friday we were looking at around about a 30-cent increase to petrol, to the grades of fuel, both of them. Today we're looking at around 35 and 33, so 5 cents difference just in a week's time. The diesel price is remaining relatively stable at the moment, Jeremy, but you know, obviously if the Rand continues to slide, this could potentially be very bad news going into May.
And there's also a double whammy because we have to factor in the volatility currently of global oil prices that would affect the price at the pump, and that shows no sign of abating.
It doesn't. You know, I mean, when you look at it, since January, we've lost around 12% on Brent, which is obviously the benchmark. You know, developments, the geopolitical developments that I think we're all aware of in the Middle East, and OPEC cutting production, things like that are definitely having an impact on that oil price. And as you rightly say, both of these factors, the rand and the oil price, would most probably have a very negative impact on petrol going into May. Let's have a look and hope it doesn't have that same impact on diesel.
Why would diesel decrease in price and we have an increase in the petrol price? Draw the comparison for me.
I think we need to understand that two different types of fuel. The manufacturing processes are different, and that alone gives you a difference in the pricing of these two fuels. It's like having a Granny Smith apple and a Red Ruby apple. They're still apples, but they're different.
And just finally, Leighton, ruin my weekend for me completely. What kind of hikes are we looking at next month then?
Well, based on the current data for petrol, we're looking at around 35 cents a litre increase, a decrease of around 30 cents for diesel, and around about a 20 cent decrease for illuminating paraffin. So I think it's obviously a mixed bag. The big issue there, of course, is the increase to petrol, and that's going to hurt consumers the most. The fact that diesel isn't going to go up at this stage of the month is good news for consumers, because that means the input costs aren't going to get higher. So very much a mixed bag. So if you've got a diesel vehicle, Jeremy, I think you'd be smiling. But if you're running a petrol motor at the moment, I think you're going to feel the pain in May.
All I can say in reply, Leighton Beard, is how them apples. Thank you very much for joining me from the Automobile Association. On our online poll yesterday, a probe into school discipline camps. I asked you if they were character building, cruel, or if they should be discontinued. Almost half of our respondents say initiatives like this are a good thing. Today, and relating to an earlier interview today about South Africa's entrepreneurship potential, do you think we have it? Is it getting better? Do we have a poor environment? Or maybe you are an entrepreneur and you've tried but you've failed. If you have a view on that, please share it with the MoneyWeb at Midday community. Go to MoneyWeb on Twitter X or on our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at Midday, we are live at noon weekdays, then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.